This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Fantastic to have you with us for another episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. It's about parenting this afternoon. And, well, a survey came out of the UK revealed that 1 in 12 parents regrets having children. It is perhaps the ultimate taboo. So we were exploring this topic with one woman who is child-free by choice, two mums who were sharing their experiences, the ups and the downs of motherhood, and we were speaking to a parenting coach who was busting a few myths too. It's safe to say the expectation is the root of all heartache. So how can we lower those expectations before having children or even after they are here in the world? So honestly, everything when it comes to kids can feel so much worse when you've had no sleep. So we brought Julie Mallon, sleep consultant, live for a sleep clinic to answer your questions, help you get a good sleep routine in place, even over the summer when it's all gone to pot. And we were meeting a young swimmer called Sajan. He's here in the UAE training before heading off to the Olympics. But what's been happening behind the scenes? Plus, the woman that brought him here to Dubai shares her thoughts on what it means to be a parent of competitive children. How can you help them deal with disappointment?
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
There is absolutely no judgment on how you fill in that blank. Before I became a parent, I wish I had. Now, being a parent is wonderful. It's magical. I honestly wouldn't have it any other way, but it does change your life. And if you're not ready for it, there could be regrets. There could be what ifs. I genuinely believe that my children are one of my greatest accomplishments. I am so proud of them endlessly. But I think every parent will have moments where they, if not regret, but certainly think, oh my goodness, it was easier before, it was cheaper before, it was less complicated before. And that's what we're talking about this afternoon. A survey out of the UK has found that 1 in 12 Brits regret becoming a parent. Younger parents, those aged 25 to 34, are the most likely to regret becoming mums and dads. And it's important to ask why. It's important to normalise this. It's important to talk about just how darn difficult it is to be a parent. The emotional side, the practical side, the economical side, no doubt. So we're going to be exploring this topic between now and 3 o'clock. We're going to be speaking to a woman who is child-free by choice. We're going to be talking about some of the trials and tribulations. And joined now by Dubai mum, Bindu Rai, who's also working full-time. She's got twins who are exactly 11 months old today. Hi, Bindu. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Helen. Thanks for having me and actually bringing me in on the show to talk about a topic that I'm actually extremely passionate about.
Can you tell us why you think it's so important to be having topics like this on the radio and in open discussion?
Because I think mothers are guilted and shamed so often that there's an absolute stigma attached to them feeling human. You know, being allowed to speak their truth. You need a safe space where mothers are allowed to say, hey, we have regrets. Hey, we have bad days. Hey, there are days that, you know, we just wish we could stay in bed and didn't have to actually wake up and change another diaper. And I think there are conversations like this that need to be had for mothers to be allowed to have that conversation without being judged over and over. And we do enough judging of our own as mothers. We have enough of our guilt that we actually bear, especially trying to balance a work and a career and motherhood. You don't need any additional judgment on top of this. And I think, which is why it's so important for, you know, Helen such as yourself, for, you know, someone such as myself. And, I, you know, life isn't easy for me. I'm taking care of twins who are less than a year old. I know exactly how it is to be sleep deprived, to be exhausted, to miss my old life. And I know I have regrets as well. And in fact, Helen, I was listening to you say that you wish you had traveled more. And I genuinely wish that I had dated my husband a lot longer. Mm-hmm. And even though we're in that stage right now, you know, I love my kids. They're fantastic. They're beautiful. And they're my greatest accomplishments. But at the same time, I have bad days too. And it's okay. It's okay to have that.
It is. It absolutely is. And I think it's so important that we acknowledge that in ourselves, because you're talking about judgment. A lot of it is self-judgment. A lot of it is, I should be doing better at this. I should be enjoying this more. I had this morning, I was like, oh, I've been looking forward to being off with the kids for so long. I've been looking forward to having the mornings with them before I come into work, them being around. And I'm honestly not exaggerating. I went to the gym early, got back, and as soon as I got home, it was like, we're bored, we want a snack. And I'm like, I've been looking forward to this, and now I'm not, and I'm not enjoying it. And I want to just lock myself in the room, because how can you be bored when you've got toys and you've got, you know, me, and you've got, you know, more than four channels? You don't know how lucky you are. And there's this self-
I just want to know how you managed to achieve to get to the gym.
Well,
it's a miracle for me to get to the bathroom.
I'll tell you how. And I think what always I find hugely frustrating and often anger making is when people don't give credit to the people in their lives. And I've got an incredible, incredible nanny called Loretta, who helps me, because she gets up at 7, and, you know, I'm on duty when I get back from the gym, but she's there giving the kids breakfast. And I think that's one of the big myths, isn't it? That you can do it all, that you are superwoman. And to not give credit to the people that make that possible does them a disservice, but it does other mums a disservice, because they've got other women going, well, how come she can go to the gym? How is she able to juggle all of that? And if I didn't acknowledge Loretta and how fortunate I am to have her in my life, It's not being honest. It's not. So I feel like, thank you for saying that you have bad days. And I think sometimes bad hours, bad days, bad weeks, if not longer, is completely normal. I, for one, don't regret having my children at all. I've had moments of, God, this is hard. This is really, you know, really hard. And I didn't realize how hard it was going to be.
Helen, I think, as you rightfully said, I think my biggest regret happened a few months ago when the entire family, every single one of us, had tested positive for COVID. And at that point, I felt like such a failure as a parent, because my one job was to keep my children safe. That is the one job every parent takes on when they decide to have a child. And I felt that I failed as a parent because I wasn't able to protect them. And that somehow snowballed into an entire conversation I had with my husband at the time, who's been my support system, I have to say, through it all. And I, in fact, did ask him that question, do you regret having children, especially at the time, bringing them into a world which is ravaged by a pandemic? And at least I know that my husband is a great sounding board for me, with whom I can have these honest conversations, with whom I can sit down and say, hey, I'm having a bad day. Did we do something wrong? And today I turn around, I see my kids, and I think, okay, they're 11 months, they're healthy. We've gotten through this together as a family, but we've had regrets. We've had setbacks. We've had health issues, but we've managed to pull through as a unit. And we've, you know, it takes a village. And we've all fallen back on each other. And I want to tell every mother out there who's listening in that it's okay to be sad. It's okay to trip and fall. It's okay to have those setbacks, because at the end of the day, things will righten itself. You just need to take it a day at a time and, you know, talk about it.
Bindi, thank you so much for your honesty today. I think the fact that you have these worries like everybody does, and I also want you to know that rationally, you know that's not right, that you couldn't have done anything to protect your children against a virus that we're still learning so much about. But in the moment, I think, you know, it happens, you know, if my kid cuts their knee, or there's, you know, you just think that shouldn't have happened. I want to turn back the clock. But we're all just trying our best. And I think you're absolutely right. We need to be able to put our hands up and say, I'm having a bad day, or I need help, I think can be some of the most powerful words that any parent can say. So Bindu, thank you for being with us this afternoon. Anonymous message here saying, they drain my energy 100%. Everything now is about them. It was much easier to just worry about myself than these tiny humans. Imagine being suddenly responsible for someone else's life, and at a time when people are losing their jobs all the time. And you're getting in touch, filling in the blank, saying, before I became a parent, I wish I had. Claire says, read more books, saved more money, says Inji. Yeah, too right. Knew more about colic, says Jess. Oh, Jess. We are families.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Talking parenting this afternoon. Fill in the blank. Before I became a parent, I wish I had... Let us know. No judgment. One in 12 Brits regrets having kids. I've been chatting to Bindu, who can understand why some parents feel that way in the US. 3 in 5 millennials say the reason they don't want to have children is because it's too expensive to raise them. And in a separate survey, American adults said they're not having kids or delaying it, mostly because of economic reasons. Can't afford them, too expensive, worried about the economy. Speaking now to Courtney Brandt, food writer based here in the UAE, who is child-free by choice. She's also from the US. How do you feel about hearing those survey results? Three in five millennials opting to be child-free, mainly for many reasons.
I would say I'm very fortunate and privileged that that was not an impact in my decision. But some of the parents I know definitely chose to have children later in life. And I would say their economic stability looked a lot different than, let's say, late 30s versus early 30s. Mm-hmm. And I can see it having an impact.
I think one of the big misconceptions about opting out of parenthood is because you don't like children, which is obviously so far from the truth. Can you tell us about some of the attitudes and even comments, questions you've had over the years?
I will say, so, you know, I have nieces and nephews. I love them. I travel with them, which surprises a lot of people. It comes down to, I think, it's having an impact or having a connection to the next generation. And for me, especially as an author and a young adult author at that, I really feel that I have that, you know, I'm passing across, looking across to the next generation. So, you know, for me and for everyone, it's different, but I've never had to have that, I guess, in a physical sense of having a child, because there's children everywhere and you can have an impact. It just depends on what your involvement level is.
You said the word decision there. Was it a conscious decision for you and your husband?
It was, and we revisited that decision, not so much in words, but like it would come up. So, you know, we would go and, you know, travel with a family or a niece would be born or something like that. So unconsciously, maybe society or friends or something, like, there are always children everywhere. And it's, I always check in with myself, usually, you know, probably around my birthday. Now I'm 41 and it's kind of a done deal. But it was important, especially in the years, let's say 35 to 40, to really be aligned and go, yes, this is still a decision I'm actively making and I'm 100% okay with it.
And I mean, I can think of many reasons why. I mean, you describe yourself as being a dink. Has anyone tell us a little bit about what dink means?
Dink. So it's dual income, no kids. And look at the hashtags that are out there. You'll see. I think I do describe myself as selfish. And that's just knowing myself and knowing that children are the ultimate sacrifice. And I see the great parents out there, you know, you're one of them, and the sacrifices that parents make to raise children, especially in 2021. And I wasn't ready to make those choices. And so I'm kind of continuing to live my life, but I only have to answer to myself and my husband. I don't have to worry about school fees or decisions and things, opportunities that come up I can easily say yes to, which I might not always be able to if I did choose to have children.
You said you're 41 now. Do you feel like there was a certain point when people stopped asking, are you going to have kids? You know, when do you think you're going to start a family?
There's only one person in my life that really thought I was going to change my mind. But for the most part, I think people who know me know I'm pretty strong in my convictions. And if I had changed my mind, I know they would be wildly supportive. But in also choosing to not have children, they were supportive in that. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, I'd love to see genetically what I look like in another generation. But my nieces through my sister are pretty darn close. And I get to see that. And I know they're going to be wonderful individuals.
It's almost like a kind of sliding doors situation. You know, I think about, had we made that decision to have no children, how different life would be, how different our bank balance would be, happiness levels. And you obviously can't make a direct comparison. But do you ever have that kind of what if moment?
We joke about it sometimes, because the other thing that's strange is I got married very young and we're still together, which I know is, you know, not everybody's as fortunate. So I've been married I've been married 18 years to my partner and we've been together for 20. So in another world, we could easily have like a 13-year-old. And sometimes we like to kind of invent what that person would be and like what they'd be interested in. So it does get spoken about. It's not like a taboo subject. Like mm-hmm. we do joke sometimes, like what if, and then how old would they be and what would their life be like? I think that's just human nature.
It is. And can I ask you, if there's anyone listening this afternoon who is perhaps wrestling with that, you know, feeling societal or family pressures to start a family when they simply don't feel like it's for them, What are some of the questions that you would recommend somebody asking themselves, or a bit of a pep talk, really, in staying true to your convictions like you have?
I think reach out to those non-parents or childless couples in your life. And you know, a friend of ours that we know in common, it comes up and we get to talk about that. So look to both sides of the table, people who had children later in life, people who chose not to, people that couldn't, people, like, there's so many different versions out there. I think for me, it's like, there's no one right answer, but if you know someone in life who is maybe like me, that is happily child-free, then reach out to them, because we're always happy to talk about it. And, you know, I think, like you said, society sometimes looks at us a little strangely, but now it's growing to be a choice that more people are making.
Courtney, thank you so much for your insights. Massively appreciate it. Really fascinating to see what's coming in on 4001 as well. I will let you get back to manning the desks at Canine Friends and give a puppy a cuddle for me. I always appreciate a cuddle by proxy. Have a good one. Thank you.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
About 1 in 12 parents regret having children, according to reports. Anonymous parents have shared their personal experiences and parenting regrets on Mumsnet, sparking a huge debate amongst them. It's revealed in new research that 8% of respondents said they wish they'd never have kids, while a further 6% admitted previously regretting it, but not anymore. Overall, YouGov's research found that 83% of parents said they'd never regretted having children. The remaining 3% chose not to say or say they didn't know. So what about you? Let us know. And you, of course, can be completely anonymous on 4001 or on the app as well. And there's absolutely no shame admitting that you feel the same way. We're really normalising how difficult it is being a parenting, and we're helping us process our negative thoughts as well as those regrets and those what ifs. We're joined now by Luz Maria Velagosuka. She is a conscious parenting coach. And I think on first day of the school holidays, for many, this conversation couldn't come a better time. We've heard from parents who wish they knew more or did more before having kids, speaking to people who are okay to be married without kids. Can I ask you, are you seeing an increasing number of couples who feel the same, Luz?
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Helen. Indeed, there are more and more parents, like you said, regretting that, you know, they had them. But the problem is here is that parents think that they will figure it out once they already have the children. Mm-hmm. And most of the parents think that having a children is a fantasy and it's so glamorous and it's all about love, hugging and kisses and unconditional love, but it's not. So parenting is about an ordinary experience of selfless. It's a repetitive behavior of changing diapers and, you know, being there in the potty, waiting for the child to, you know, do his thing. And it's about all these ordinary moments. There is no such fantasy of having a child that we love you and, you know, you go to the park and you'll watch movies with. And I think that's the problem, is this fantasy that we have about parenting. So I think educating ourselves of what really parenting is key.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right. There seems to be such a gap between expectation and reality. And that's where the disappointment, that's where often the heartbreak and where often the regrets can lie.
Absolutely. And we live in myths, you know, we live in myths, especially in parenting. We think that if we do the same thing that was done to us, if we just do what my mom did to me or what my grandmother did to me, we're going to be fine. We will figure it out. And I always talk about with parents about the most common myths in parenting, which are 7, by the way. The myth number one is parenting comes naturally. No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
Oh, it doesn't.
This is completely rubbish. The other one is parenting is about the children. No, parenting is not about the children. Parenting is about you, the parent, making sure that you're going to fix yourself, self-regulate yourself when you are bored, when there is no freedom, when there is a lot of changing diaper, breastfeeding every 2 hours, and you're going to have a good sleep. is about you, the parents and the dad, helping the mother. Because unfortunately, we are living in this individualistic society where when a mother becomes a mother, we are all alone. So everybody disappears. And it's not an individual experience. It's actually a communal. It's a community experience. So parenting is not about the children. It's about us, the parent. That's number two. The third one is a successful child is ahead of the curve. So we think we need to make our children drive and thrive and do activities and be, you know, the best at everything at school and sports. And no, it's not a race. We don't have to do that. And I would say the other ones is as important as the first three. All children should be happy. No, you know, children sometimes can't have some pain, some discomfort. It's okay. We don't have to break all over in a restaurant if our child is starting to cry. And we don't want nobody to notice that our children or our child is crying. We don't have to break. It's okay. We need to also allow the children to self-regulate themselves. Mm-hmm. It's okay. The other myth is that parenting is all about love. If you love your child, that's all your child it needs, love, love, love. But it's not true, because sometimes love cannot be felt as love from the child. Mm-hmm. So love is not enough. It has to be a conscious love. And the last two is that there are good and bad children. No, there is no good and bad children. They are just children. And they learn from us. They learn from the behaviors that we do as parents. And this is why parenting is about us and ensure that we are in our best, you know, rested and, you know, self-regulated behavior, so that the children can shadow our behavior and become the people that they want to and they came to be in this world. The last one is parenting is being in control of your children. No, it's a delusion. It's completely an illusion. We cannot be in control of our children. We can be there to support, to be friends with them, to allow them to make mistakes and being us there to support them. But we cannot have control of our children. So this myth of parenting, we should let go.
Liz, I think that is so valuable to so many people. As you say, the myths and misconceptions, not helped by social media a lot of the time, can be really, really damaging and can lead to those regrets, those what ifs. And I think a bit of real talk, like we're having this afternoon, that It's not all, you know, beautifully clean, chubby-cheeked children with ringlets who are, you know, skipping along the beach picking up shells, or, you know, these cozy. You know, I took my kids to the cinema yesterday thinking, oh, this will be nice. We'll just sit down in the dark and in the cool. Nope. They're asking for this. One wants to go home. I'm a man. I'm like, this was not the plan. This was not. And that's a tiny, minor example. When things get bad, it can be really, really bad. And I'm so glad that we're able to acknowledge that this afternoon, that it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to feel like it's not coming naturally, because my goodness, I think that kind of maternal and paternal instinct it's driven a lot of people to despair.
Yeah, and I would say, Helen, when you get liberated from those expectations, from those fantasies that you have in your head to be that amazing parent, you will liberate from that need of fixing or shaping your children. And it will take away so much load from you. And you will naturally, as parent, whether you're a mom or a dad, you'll be better with them. You'll be more naturally available to them. Because you know what? The irony enough is that children only need the presence, the availability of presence with their parents. Even I always say this with my clients, even animals know this. When a lion or a cat or a dog, they have cubs, the lion cubs, they play in the presence of the parents, of the mother, the lioness and the lion, and they play. And in the play is that they learn to survive. And children are the same. They just want to be with mom and dad and just play, you know, connect with them, have this presence that gives them actually self-esteem, confidence, and they'll be fine with just being there. But what we do in our society, we are trying to, you know, through the social media, like you say, do, thrive, thrive, thrive.
Give, more, give, give, more, bye, more. Bye, bye.
Give, yeah. Give, give, bye, bye. Take them here. The other activity, no, because she said that and I should go here. And so this is when we get it all wrong and we start to overload ourselves, stress. And of course, you're going to hate parenting. You know, of course you're going to hate parenting because it's so much of demands, expectations that we parents create, not even the children.
Liz, thank you so much for the real talk. Really, really appreciate it. And if you want Liz's details, message us on 4001. We will connect you if you want some individual coaching and some more real talk about real life and real parenting. Lots of messages coming in on this. Love this from Rami saying, parenting is tough, but through our continuous journey with a four-year-old boy, we feel the rewards outweigh the tough times. Same. Absolutely the same. Vic says, everyone regrets it at some point or another, but everything worth doing is hard, isn't it? And Jess saying, many times I felt I failed as a parent, didn't understand the importance of giving my child a normal life for 4 years, couldn't balance taking care of a child and a terminally ill parent, often frustrated with the demands of a child and not knowing what to do. Impact of past decisions continue to affect our lives today. Lessons learned, we can still correct the present. There's no perfect parent and it's all right to cry and ask for help. Well said indeed. And again, there are many reasons why couples delay becoming parents. Here's Maria Botras.
So we haven't considered having kids yet because we just got married and we don't think like that we're ready for it. We feel like we're still a little young and we want to travel. We want to do a lot of things before, you know, having that added responsibility. So I think it's just one of the main reasons. And obviously the financial responsibility, the financial aspect of it is also something that we've considered. And that's been, you know, sort of delaying our plans of, you know, starting a family and having kids.
The economic aspect being highlighted by Nadia. She's saying on 4001, before I had kids, I wish I saved for the school fee. Yeah, same, same, same.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Family does matter indeed, but research shows that almost all couples, 92%, experience increased conflict during the first year of parenthood. The most divisive issue being the division of workload. Parenthood, and two-thirds reporting their relationship suffered during the first 3 years of having a child. Let us know if you've got any parenting regrets. Or equally, if you want to join our competition this afternoon, fill in the blank. Before I became a parent, I wish I had... Lots of you saying travelled more. 4001 or via the ARN Play app. Nidhi Bruce joining us now, a Dubai mum of three and a life coach who says she was shocked and, in her own words, throttled myself full speed into postpartum depression, no matter how much she prepared for having her first child. Nidhi, why was that?
Well, it was because, you know, when I got pregnant for the first time, like all first-time parents, I had prepared myself. I'd read the books. I'd joined the classes. I had this image of myself being this nice, perfect parent, you know, who knew everything, who could do everything, handle everything. But the minute my kid was born and, you know, all the things that came along with it, like, you know, not being able to breastfeed immediately after, all the pains which come with it, and just the sudden feeling of being in charge of this little mewling baby, it was a shocking experience. But like I mentioned in the post that you just read out, it was a couple of years of that with my first child because it was all figuring it out, right? Every single day was a new challenge thrown in your face, which you were not prepared for. But as the months went along and as the years went along, it got better and better. You get better as parents, right? Mm-hmm. And you also lower the expectations on yourself.
Yes. That is key. Honestly, my parenting mantra is better, you know, better to be done than perfect. Because if you keep on chasing that perfection, those expectations that you think are being set for you or by you, you're just chasing your tail and it becomes a never-ending struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does feel like chasing your tail in the beginning, right? Because there's no end to it. It's like a spiral. Yeah. So my experience actually got better. And I really wanted to highlight that. Because with my first child, it was a huge struggle. And like I mentioned, I also went into postpartum depression. And I really wish that somebody had told me that I can seek out help. And, you know, I could ask for help, which is something I didn't do very much in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So the thing is, I had my second kid after a gap of 6 years, which was not planned. It just happened. But by the time I got pregnant with my second kid, I was like, I'm going to ask for all the help. Because,
And the same with me, you know yourself better as a parent. I had a very instant connection with my first baby. It was that moment of I've fallen in love. And I didn't have that with my second, but I knew in that moment that if things didn't feel right to me, then I knew who to go to, and I had the confidence to do that. When it's your first baby, you're in the wilderness. You really are. And you know, there is a happy ending for you. You know, you've got through it, and as I said, you've got three kids now. How's the parenting journey now?
Oh, it's still a lot of fun. There are days when, you know, there are ups and there are downs, as usual. But the only thing is I have changed, and I was listening to Louisa, who was on a little while ago with you. And what she said really made sense. There's a lot of repetition and there is a lot of ordinary in parenting. Mm-hmm. But it also has a little bit of extraordinary.
It does.
So
it does.
Yeah. So it is those extraordinary moments really make it worthwhile. And now I've started enjoying my kids. I have, like, my youngest is 4 years old, my eldest is 14. So there's a huge gap and there's a lot of variation in ages. So I can sit back and, you know, really look at them and say, okay, great. This is fun. Let's see what happens next.
And I think that's exactly right. It's about finding the magic in the mundane. And I think to everyone listening today who's been having any doubts or any of those what ifs, ask for help if you need it. And I can guarantee you're doing a better job than you think you are. Nidhi, really appreciate your honesty this afternoon. So important to be having these discussions. And let us know if you've got any parenting regrets. Rob saying not being able to be off work for the first 3 or 4 years after our kids arrive to help their superstar mum and share in every minute. You can't turn back the clock, but you can pick up the phone.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Children and correspondingly parents across Dubai are not getting enough sleep, and this needs to change. That's according to our next guest, Julie Mallon, a Dubai-based sleep consultant. She's joining us on Microsoft Teams, on hand to answer all of your questions about your children and their sleeping or not sleeping habits. I'm going to jinx it. Touching all the wood, we are out of the trenches, but only just. In the last week or so, my children started sleeping till 6, which I know doesn't sound... If my 27-year-old self could hear me going, they slept till 6, this is a breakthrough. This is a breakthrough for me, because for a while I was getting the 4:47, Mummy, can we play with Lego wake-up calls, which, trust me, is not a good way to start the day. So, Julie, I've had a pretty good night's sleep, so therefore I'm in a pretty good mood. We're talking about the difficulties of parenting, and my goodness, everything is so much worse when you haven't had enough sleep as a parent. What are some of the issues, the concerns that parents are coming to you with right now?
Like you were saying, Helen, and hello, and thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome.
I love it. I want to educate as many parents as possible and share knowledge. I think it's really interesting what you were saying about how much better you feel for your good night's sleep. It's the exact same with our children. When children don't get that good night's sleep, we really see them acting out. Now, acting out being not acting up, but acting out. And those feelings of frustration, those feelings of not being able to cope, and just really lost, because, you know, with children who are pre-verbal, they haven't the skills to explain to you, I'm feeling really tired, Mommy, or I don't. So there are so many ways that we can help our children and really look to how we can improve their sleep. And in terms of what parents are coming to me, it's the range is vast. I can have a 3-year-old who was sleeping and then suddenly isn't. I can have a family whose children are really struggling now with anxiety, and the anxiety is impacting their sleep. I had a conversation with a school nurse yesterday, and it's a secondary school, and I couldn't leave because she wanted to talk so much about the teenagers who are coming to her with sleep problems, newborns, you know, new parents. So the range is vast.
You mentioned anxiety there, disruption in routine. devices. You know, there are so many reasons I'm sure that you're coming across why children simply aren't getting enough sleep. And let's talk about anxiety there. And I mean, this year and a half, so many people suffering from increased anxiety or indeed anxiety for the first time. And our children pick up on this, whether they are, you know, anxious by nature or they're simply getting that signal, that energy from their parents. Do you have any advice, Julie, for calming anxious children, getting them ready for bedtime and them understanding that this is the time to be calm and quiet?
I think the first step is to acknowledge that it starts with us. And it's really fascinating because very recently there's been a place in an area of the brain which has just been recognized like in the late 1980s, which is very recent in terms of our brain recognition and awareness. But it's called the HTP5 or H5 part of the brain, and it's the mirror neurons. Now, what that means is if as a parent we are feeling stressed and anxious, no matter what we are saying to our children, we have actually triggered the mirror neuron in our children that you are anxious and stressed. And so we project that within our children. So first and foremost, as hard as it is, basically it's fake it till you make it. But as hard as it is, mm-hmm. you have to let your children know that they may be, you know, their ship may be sinking, but you're their calm. They need to be able to look to you. So modeling that calm. And even if you're not calm, modeling what you can do about it. So you might use the traffic light system of, you know, I am angry, I'm happy, I'm furious, you know, so giving your children strategies to help them know how to deal with their feelings of not feeling calm, their feelings of frustration. So that's the first thing. And then, of course, one of the most important things is that to have that predictable bedtime routine, regardless of children's ages. I mean, there was a very a huge study recently that was saying, and it was replicated here in Dubai, actually, in Jumeirah Baccalaureate School, they sent out a similar study. And teenagers need parents to be in charge. And what this study concluded was that we might think our teenagers want to be left alone to go to sleep when they're ready. Actually, that's the complete opposite. Our teenagers really want us to put those limits and boundaries in place.
And they need it.
To help them. Yeah. Yeah.
And also let us know your top sleep tips for me. I love a pillow spray. I love it. A little spritz on the pillow. Then I take my magnesium and I am out. One here saying, best sleep tip, 100% listening to sounds of rain, thunder and lightning on my headphones. Make sure you go to the toilet before you listen to rainfall. We are
family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Sleep consultant Julie Mallon joining us live on the line. You mentioned earlier, Julie, some sleep cues, bedtime routines, and there's never going to be a one size fits all for all children of all ages. But are you able to offer up some suggestions, things that can be woven into the evening to get our kids in the right frame of mind for going to sleep?
And, you know, that's really very true, Helen, when you're saying there isn't a one size fits all. But the predictability of your routine is going to be one of the most helpful gauges and helpful signals to the brain. But there's other things. I mean, and everybody knows it, and yet we still really struggle. The use of screen time, the use of any devices. Now, it will change throughout the ages, but we know, for example, from birth to 1 year and up until two, a child really shouldn't be exposed to screen. That's what all the Academy of Pediatrics, whether it's in, you know, the American Academy, whether it's European, the guidance are that children under the age of two should not be exposed to screen. But, you know, it is a digital world, which makes it very difficult. But the reason why you would really make sure that up to one-year-old was not exposed to screen time is because they are their brain is very, very sensitive to the blue light, that invisible blue light that comes off the screen. And so where a child's circadian rhythm is very fragile, that blue light from the screen absolutely knocks it out. Now, when we're talking about the circadian rhythm, you know, it comes in for our children up until the age of 11. So if we are looking at the children's internal body clock, their melatonin, that natural sleep aid that's really going to support a child's sleep, it's like a tap that's turned on, and that comes on roughly, or comes into their blood system roughly around 6 o'clock in the evening. So even if, you know, if they're traveling, not that we're traveling that much this year, but, you know, once a child is on the time zone of wherever we are, their melatonin still comes in around 6 o'clock, whether you're in, I don't know, Bali or Australia or Dubai, it still comes in at around 6 o'clock. Okay. So that is the cue to the brain to get ready for sleep. So if they, up to 2 hours before bedtime, if they are exposed to a screen, then that really does disrupt their sleep. Now, I'm not talking about just at the beginning of the night, but it will disrupt their sleep the entire night. Because this circadian rhythm, this melatonin, is such a fragile hormone. And again, just to give you some idea of how fragile it is, and I mean, I know you've read the Matthew Walker book, and he gives that research where there was the social experiment carried out, and is carried out every year, twice a year, where when the clocks go forward in 19 different countries, so when the clocks go forward and we lose 1 hour's sleep, there is an increase in heart attacks by 26%. And when it goes back and we gain an hour, there is a decrease of 21 to 24%. Now that's in an adult, and that's a fully functioning brain. And so if we think about our children whose brains are developing, that impact of the screen on their melatonin, on their circadian rhythm, is even greater. So that's the first thing. Limit the screen time. Really, really limit it.
Julia, I wanted to ask you about that blue light around screens. Does that mean that you would advocate for kind of softer, warmer lighting if there's going to be a night light or a light on in the bedroom in the evening, rather than cooler tones?
Yeah, very, very definitely. And things like, you know, if you have a child in their bathroom, when they go for their bath in the evening, you really, really need it for it to be that orange white light, mm-hmm. because then that promotes the flow of melatonin, and it is signaling to the brain what time it is, that it is 6:30 in the evening, not 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. You know, the night light that you might read the story to your children, make sure that is not LED lighting, because that's giving off the same blue light as the screen. So dimming everything down, you know, from approximately 5:30 is really promoting the flow of melatonin and really helping the children prepare their body and their brain for sleep.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Children in Dubai are losing sleep, and this needs to change. That's according to Julie Malin, a Dubai-based sleep consultant. She's joining us now on Microsoft Teams, answering your question about your children and their sleeping, or indeed lack of sleeping habits. We've had so many messages. We're going to do a bit of a text quickfire round. Is that okay with you? Have you had a coffee?
No, I did early. Remember, it's getting late for coffee.
Julie, you're speaking to a woman whose husband will have 2 double espressos at 10 o'clock at night and still manages to be asleep before me. So my world of coffee is completely skewed, thanks to Mr. Farmer. You were discussing earlier the importance of reducing device time in general, but certainly in the hours before bedtime. A message here saying, does a TV have the same effect as tablets?
It has less of effect, and it's basically that blue light is not as strong, but it is still strong. And it's also not just the blue light, but it's also the content in which they're watching. Because if we're thinking about if it's a children's program, we know that the producers know the attention span of each particular age. And the younger the child, the faster the frames are moving in the program they're watching. So therefore, it's really putting their brain on high alert. Mm-hmm. So yes, a screen would be better than, say, an iPad, but None of them. They all give off blue light and they are all going to disrupt sleep.
OK, Julie, thank you so much. Right. To the text line 4001 saying we've got a 14 month old still wakes up once to have milk and will drink a good 180 millilitres. She's on the lower percentile for her age, so I'm going along with it. In between, she'll wake up, but if I put her close to me, she'll settle. It's when she doesn't settle that I give her milk. What are your thoughts on nighttime feeds, 14-month-old, and sounds a bit unsettled in general, Julie?
Well, we know that with a 14-month-old, they have the capacity to literally go from 7 o'clock in the evening until 6 in the morning without requiring calories. Now, these calories, now, of course, there's going to be exceptions to the rule if they're having a growth spurt or if they've been unwell for a couple of days. So I'm not saying across the board. It's always that we want to respond to our children, but not react to our children. And, you know, at 14 months, they're just on the cusp of a cognitive leap. So, you know, we are feeding, we eat when we when we're hungry and we sleep when we're tired. And what's happening with this little one, we're giving very confusing messages. And so, first of all, we are rewarding the wake up. So we're giving her or him something to wake up for, because they don't know whether it's 2 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning. All they know is the end part of this wake up. I'm given milk. The second thing is that with giving the milk, the body is now really wasting its energy on breaking down those complex carbohydrates and proteins within the milk, when really it should be restoring and repairing and growing. And we're kind of setting one, you know, the child up for later on about expecting food in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. But this is much more a behavioral problem rather than a hunger problem. And even though she is on the lower centile, it's much better that we give her real food during the day and look at, you know, nutrients dense foods such as a sleep smoothie is a great one for helping. A sleep smoothie would have, and now that this child is more than a year, she can have a teaspoon of honey. Honey is so good for sleep because honey allows the blood-brain barrier to open and to really manufacture all these neurotransmitters and melatonin. So you'd have a teaspoon of honey, you'd have some coconut milk, which is a really good fat. It's antibacterial and anti-inflammatory. You would have spinach for iron. So I don't know if I said this to you before or not, Helen, but do you know that a seven-month-old baby requires the same iron content as a 30-year-old male?
Wow.
Yeah, I know. So look at ways that we can get iron into our children. Mm-hmm. So spinach, avocado, these are all really good fats that are going to stabilize the child's blood sugar throughout the night, stabilize their insulin, and it's really going to encourage them to not require the food. But with this little one, it's much more developmental, it's much more behavioral, and has very little to do with hunger.
All right, thanks, Julie. Love the sound of the sleep smoothie. Dorian's been in touch saying, basically a weird one, but I don't know how to make it stop. My two-year-old has always woken up at 7 a.m. or thereabouts, but for a few weeks now, she's woken up around 6 every morning needing to poo. She says, Mummy, how can I make my poo stop waking me? I literally can't think how to change up her poo routine. Mine's like clockwork, but luckily I'm already up. Thank you for the clarification. A two-year-old.
Okay. So interestingly, again, all things sleep fascinating. I think what's going on at the minute is that this little girl, which is very common around this age, that they have a huge shift in their biological clock. Now, what I mean by that is, and I'm going to sound very nerdy here, so apologies, but literally behind our eyes, there's a group of cells, and they're like your GMT. So that's your, there's this master clock, and that keeps all the other clocks in our body on time. And we have 37 in our body. And so if the light going into our eyes or a shift within the brain, then all our other clocks, and one of them is bodily functions, one of them is having a poo, that's going to be knocked out. And this is really common around the age of 2. So not to worry, this is temporary and it will settle down. But things that you can do is look at what they're having in the evening. You know, are they having like brown rice? And of course we want them to have healthy food, absolutely. But maybe shift the brown rice to lunchtime so their body has time to break it down. If you've just recently started potty training, that will always also be a factor that is shifting things. And then the other thing is look at, see what the light is coming into the room, because we know now that I think the sun is rising at present at 5:35. And so if the light into the child's room is enough to cancel out the melatonin, that's going to trigger these bodily functions of getting ready to poo. So there's a number of things.
Get your blackout blinds sorted out. Pretend you're in a hotel.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Crucially, talking about how to help your child get a good night's sleep. Routines probably a little bit out of the window over the summer through school not being on, perhaps travelling. But how can we make sure there is an element of structure? So come September, you are not battling to get back into some good habits. Julie Mellon's with us this afternoon, a Dubai-based sleep consultant. Going to the text line, I presume Michael is a grown-up. We are talking kids' sleep, but Michael, I think this is a great question. Saying, I monitor my sleep and I found that I get very little deep sleep. Should I be worried? Julie, can you explain a little bit about what deep sleep is and why it is so important?
So there are five stages that we go through in one sleep cycle. We have stage one, stage two, stage three, and stage three is where the deep sleep happens. We have stage four, and then we have REM sleep. So those really are the stages of sleep that we have, and we cycle in and out of sleep. And on average, as an adult, we wake up approximately 26 times per night. But of course, we're not aware of it, and so we just go back to sleep. Now, if we're looking at deep sleep, again, it varies depending on our age. So if Michael is an adult, if he is under 30, he will require more deep sleep than somebody who is older than 30. Equally, if, you know, there's lots of research now looking at deep sleep, and as we age, our level of deep sleep sadly goes down. And certainly from 60 years onwards, we really do, our deep sleep is very much depleted. Now, if we're looking at our children, and again, it's all about age related, but deep sleep is when we grow. So with our children, I mean, the adage of we only grow in the dark. And that's because when we are in deep sleep, there's really important hormones that are released into the body. And one of these very important hormones is the growth hormone. Now, with our children, that growth hormone is released early on in the evening, you know, from 7 o'clock, somewhere around 7, 8 o'clock to around 12, 1 o'clock. So it is really important that we do, the children before the age of 11 do have an early bedtime. And that is so supported by all the neuroscience data saying that the golden hour for sleep, and I know there's lots of parents going to balk at this, but the golden hour for sleep, according to the neuroscience data, is 7 o'clock.
Listen, get those kids into bed so I can have an evening, Julie. I've absolutely no argument from me. I put them into bed at 6:30 the other night. So, but I think it is very tempting over the summer to be like, well, they haven't got school, and you know, we're gonna see friends, or we're gonna be somewhere. How important is it to have the same bedtime every night?
So, just to finish the question with Michael, we don't actually need as much deep sleep as we think. So, with the sleep tracker that he's talking about, most of these devices are very, very inaccurate. And so, for example, if you're doing a sleep study, these will not be used. Most of these sleep devices, and unfortunately, what they're actually creating is just anxiety. And somewhere between 1 and 2 hours in his total of 8 hours sleep should be deep sleep. But he's also got to accompany this by how he feels in the morning. If he wakes up and he's really tired, he needs the alarm to wake him up, then that is a cue to him to say, okay, so you need more sleep. And then going back to your question about routine and with our children, how do we get them back on track? How important it is for them to have the routine? So coming up to Eid, for example, we know families are getting together, bedtimes are later. What you really want to be looking at here is that we do want our children to be with their families and have the best time. But equally, a tired child is a miserable child, and we have a miserable parent too. Yes. Yeah. So what we really want is to for the parent to be very aware of the minimum amount of time that that child needs so they don't fall apart. Mm-hmm. So we all have different sleep needs. My sleep need is definitely lower than my husband's. I think he's got mine. And, you know, my three daughters, theirs are very different too. So, you know, when they were small, I was very aware of their sleep needs. You know, Tara's sleep need was very different from her sister's, Melissa's, and Eleanor's was different again. So look at your child, and if you know that they can get by for one or two nights, you're not going to cause everything to fall apart. But you really need to pay attention to what their behavior is telling you. Behind every behavior is a communication.
Absolutely. Julie, thank you so much for your time this afternoon. I know you're very busy with consultations, and you can find Julie. If you want Julie's details, message us on 4001 and I will send them over to you. If we ran out of time, but we haven't run out of questions, so we will absolutely have Julie back as we continue to talk sleep, certainly ahead of school going back in September.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Great to have you with us on this Sunday afternoon. Helen Farmer with you. And we are meeting now a young swimmer who is heading to the Olympics with a little bit of help from friends in the UAE. Sachin Prakash with us this afternoon. He started his journey in sports. His mum is an athlete at just 5 years old. A swimmer who's been moving up the ladder and has his sets. Well, sat on that podium. Sachin, can you tell us a little bit about your first memories of swimming?
Hi, thanks for having me here. I started swimming at the age of 5 in India, in a place called Neyveli, where my mother was an athlete and she put me in many sports. And at last, I found the love for swimming, and I slowly progressed in the sport and started winning. And at the age of 13, I won my first national medal when I'm representing Tamil Nadu. And then at the age of 17, I moved to Bangalore to swim at national coach of India, Mr. Pradeep Kumar, who is also the current coach in ANSA in Dubai. I think from my 18 years, I started progressing and it's been a life-changing experience. I came to Dubai last year to aiming to qualify for the Olympics. And everything is going as planned. I'm happy to be training in Dubai right now.
We're so happy that you're here. And it sounds like it's been a bit of an up and down journey. You had an injury back in December 2019. What happened?
2019 December, I got a slip disc on my neck, which has been triggering on my left shoulder. So it kept me away from the pool for 8 months with all the lockdown and things. I only started training when I came to Dubai in August last year.
How did it feel to not be able to do something that you loved?
For 4 months, I was under rehab. Then the lockdown happened. I was stuck in Thailand at that point. It was frustrating and depressing that I lost self-belief at that point where I didn't think I could make it to the Olympics. But postponing the Olympics for one more year was, I think it was a blessing for me and it gave me some more time to prepare for the Olympics.
I love a positive out of the pandemic. This is a thing that the absolute precision timing required for athletes such as yourself to be in the best possible performance, you know, state for the Olympics. It's a science. So for you to have that time to rehab, to qualify, can you tell us what happens behind the scenes, Sachin? What do you need to do to qualify for the Olympics, using swimming, obviously, as your example?
I had, in swimming, we say if you take 1 day off, it equals to 2 days of training when you get back. It took a long time for me to first get healthy from and recover from the injury and then slowly start progressing from then to, you know, at the elite level of the extreme level of performance. I think the first thing I had to do is stay around positive people when I came to Dubai, the positive vibes. I think the team has helped me, the Aqua Nation Swimming Academy has helped me feel like a family, and the team spirit and the love for the sport and around me, the positive people, it has helped me in a huge, it's been a huge impact on my performance.
So tell us when Vijay came into your life. She is, She owns a swimming academy. She is a mum of two international swimmers. She's brought you here. Yeah. How did she hear your story?
We know each other for around, I think, about 4 years now. I've been coming to Dubai earlier as well. But because of this pandemic and my injury case, she and her husband, George Matthew, they helped me to come to Dubai. They said it was all about the positivity. They gave me that when I was injured, they just told me to, you get your bags and come to Dubai. We will take care of you. Oh. I think that word that day, it has helped me a lot just get me safer in my soul, you know. Mm-hmm. That's more important than anything else. Her son, Tanish, is my teammate who also traveled with me for the qualification meets.
So tell us then about what training looks like now. What are you eating? How much are you swimming?
I eat as much as, but I stay at my coach's house. The coach's wife, Gauri Pradeep, helps me with all the homely environment and the food. That's also one of the major part for an athlete's performance. I try to eat at home, eat clean, try to be in a healthier part. I train 10 sessions a week, which comprises of 2 hours a session and then 4 dry land sessions a week. So we swim about 60, 70 kilometers per week.
Oh my goodness. And what is the event you're going to be competing in Tokyo?
I qualified in 200 meter butterfly with a qualifying time, which will be closer to semi-finals at the Olympics. I will probably swimming one event in Tokyo, which is 200 meter butterfly.
Can I ask you, obviously, this event's taking place in 2021 during a pandemic, and the spectator situation is going to be very different to Rio, where you were, and to previous championships. How much energy do you get from the crowd, or are you actually quite looking forward to the concentration that the quiet will bring?
I think when I used to race in India at my home state in Kerala, the crowd's cheering and support, you know, at that point when we race, it's huge. And then, you know, the Indian crowd, they are crazy about sports sometimes, and then it gives us the boost and motivation to perform that 1% more. I think that plays a huge impact. But without the crowd, and it's going to be a unique Olympics where it's going to be one of its kind. We never experienced something like this. I hope everything goes well or positive at Olympics.
So are you feeling ready? Do you think you might get a medal? What's your attitude going into it?
Me and my coach, we put in all the work earlier. We went to Italy for the qualification and we did it as we planned. And going to the Olympics, my realistic goal is to first qualify for the semifinals. And with that, it's realistic that with my time, I can see that the semifinals is happening, probably to the finals. I'm honestly considering that.
Well, we will be cheering you on, even if we're not in that sports hall. We'll be here in Dubai. Sachin, it's so great to have you training here in Dubai. Wishing you all the very best. Wonderful to hear of someone who's really, truly followed his passion and has had some helping hands along the way. We're going to be speaking to Vijay and your coach next. Where can people follow your journey if they want to find you on social media? What's the best way of tracking down Sachin Prakash?
I'm active on Instagram, and I post a lot about swimming there. So it's the best way I think you can find my sources there.
Sachin, thank you so much. I'm sure you're probably late for a pool session right now with 10 with 10 to 14 sessions a week. I'm sure you're always on the way to the pool or on the way back. So thank you for sparing us the time, and all the very best from us here at Dubai Eye 103.8. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you. Bye.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It is Sunday and we are talking sports. We heard earlier from Olympic hopeful Sachin, who's going to be heading to Tokyo, taking part in 200 meter butterfly. And he thinks he's heading for the final. We truly hope that's going to be the case. And we're speaking now to the woman that brought him to Dubai for training and has put him on his way to Olympic, hopefully gold. Vijay Susan Matthews, the Managing Director of Aquanation Sports Academy. She's the mum of two swimmers herself and managed to arrange Sajan's trip here to the UAE last August. Vishi, thank you so much for being with us today. Can you tell us a little bit about how you first heard about Sajan?
Sajan, yes, definitely. He was at the top and he did go through an injury. And we know Sajan for a long time because he also swims. My son is also a swimmer. He's an international swimmer and his main stroke is 200 butterfly. That is how we got to know Sajan long back. And when we heard from Coach Pradeep that Sajan is going through a difficult time and he went through an injury, and for a sports person, injury is like a taking a setback from their day-to-day activities and whatever goal that they have, they won't be able to meet. Though it is a part and parcel of a sports person, but his vision or a goal was always to go for a second Olympics, which was a deterrent for him. The injury took a complete back step. And when we got to know about the injury and we were talking to Coach Pradeep, and he was very upset that Sajan is going through a difficult time, and not only the injury, it is a mental stress and the pressure that he is going through. And immediately we took a call saying we are his family and we will make sure that he will come back and recover as fast as possible. So that is how we decided, at once we gave a call to Sajan and said, please don't worry about anything. Don't worry about expenses, stay, whatever it is. We are your family. Please come to Dubai. And that is how he said yes. And in that state of mind, he said yes, definitely. He took a next flight and came. We believe in providing an ecosystem for the sportsmen. And it is to strive and create and nurture the talent and give them a positive environment so that they will overcome all their difficulties and meet their goals. So that is the vision that we have, and that definitely comes with our passion as I have two children who are sportsmen, and my daughter is doing her sports management in Canadian University. This is the final year, and my son is trying for Olympics. So he's somewhere close to a B cut in 200 meter freestyle and close, he's trying for his butterfly as well. I can understand how an athlete goes through in tough times. Mm-hmm. And that is when we decided Sajan to bring him over here to Dubai and give him that environment. We focused on what better he can do, how he can overcome all his difficulties, and just focus on the training rather than thinking of a whole lot of other things which was back of his mind. Mm-hmm. And the goal for him was always he wants to be the first Indian to go for the second Olympics and make an A cut. So that was always his goal. And which we believed from Aquanation, we support him, give him that environment. And the team who is training in ANSA is also, we build a culture or environment where we only look at the positive, what a person can achieve maximum to their capabilities rather than what other person is achieving. That brings out the strength in each and every person, so which makes them mentally, emotionally, physically more stronger because they are looking at their own goals and how they can improve step by step. So that is the holistic approach that we take. When Sajan came over here, he was so comfortable because the environment is such that he immediately gelled well. The infrastructure, which is a world-class infrastructure, there is no deterrent in his training or stay. And of course, he loves Indian mutton biryani, and he's
getting eating a taste of home, and he's getting some emotional support.
Yes, we love cooking, and my husband is an excellent. He works for HP, and he's a sportsman himself.
We think about training camps, and he mentioned earlier, 10 swimming sessions, 4 dry sessions a week. Swimming 70 kilometers a week. He needs a bit of love and support, and as you say, some mutton biryani in his stomach to keep him going. What's that support team going to be like in Tokyo? Have you thought that far ahead yet? Who's going to go with him?
His coach, Pradeep Kumar sir, will be accompanying him, and the Team India, as COVID, there are a lot of restrictions that they have to follow. The contingent from India will be going, and our Indian national coach and Mr. Pradeep Kumar, he will also be going along with him.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Vijie Matthews owns a swimming academy here in Dubai, and she brought over Sajan, an Olympic swimmer, into India to train here ahead of Tokyo. He's leaving next week, and following an injury, he got back into the groove and the pool with a rigorous training regime. Vijie is also mum to two international swimmers herself, and she says it's not easy being a swim mum.
Definitely, it's a lots of early morning and lots of sacrifice, not only from the parent, it is the sacrifice from the child. Mm-hmm. So we need to give them, it especially for all the budding, you know, the small young parents specifically, I keep talking to them and how we can look at, you know, molding the children. So it is a holistic approach. It's not only just an academic for a child. It is overall development of a child is what we need to look at. So a lot of sacrifice that we need to go through so that we can build a champion. It is not easy, Helen, making sure that your child is a champion. It's not only just inborn talent, there are a lot of sacrifice in the ecosystem which will go in. One, definitely the child and the coach. Apart from that, parent play a major role. That major role is one, discipline, bringing the child on a regular basis to the pool. And once they get into a competitive swimming, there is a lot of stress the child goes through, emotional, mental, physical. So you are just a support system. And you are, you know, slowly what happens is I become his nutritionist and his counselor.
Yeah, psychologist. And
whenever, yeah, psychologist. So whenever the child goes through the difficult phase, so the tough training that you must have heard, even Tanish is going through, my son Tanish is going through a tough training. So I can understand emotionally how, you know, difficult it is for them to go through. And once they come back home, they need that kind of a support to rest, rehab. Then you have a, you know, a sports massage, you know, physiotherapy. So all these are, you know, a person needs to coordinate well to make sure that they give them overall support for an athlete.
And Vijie, so, can I ask then, as a mother, when, you know, someone doesn't bring home a medal and everything they've worked so hard towards, you know, isn't realized, any advice for parents? And I'm talking about, it could be swim squad at school, it could be a report or any kind of so-called failure in life. Have you got any advice for helping parents help their children deal with it?
Definitely. So what happens is, Helen, we look at sports in a different way altogether. Sports is not only just bringing medals. It is overall development of a child to learn how to fail. So learn how to fail is the biggest, skill in current situation. So what happens is parents just look at, oh, my child needs to get 90% in his or her exam, or he needs to excel whatever sports they do. But in overall in life, it doesn't work that way. A child who learns in very early age how to fail, they'll overcome all the difficulties in their life later. So what happens if they fail? What happens if they don't win a medal? Life doesn't stop. Life has to move on. They need to work more harder day by day. And one or the other day, you will win in a different way. Mm-hmm. So that is what, you know, the sports teaches each and every person. How you can fail and still overcome, and there is a next chance. So emotionally and mentally, they become so strong that if I fail, it is okay. Again, there is another day, there is another competition which I can prepare much better and again go back to the world or go back for the next competition. So that attitude will help them in a long run in their professional life. So they don't hesitate in taking any extra step, thinking, okay, what happens if I fail? So that strength, mental strength, is built through sports. So So we strongly believe that, and we motivate all the parents. Especially, I spend a lot of time with these young parents in understanding and also explaining and giving them that, you know, I have already gone through, and, you know, my kids are in a level where I can say how was my journey and what I have gone through and what they can expect. So it is not a short-term goal that, you know, I put the child and within 3 months a child becomes an Olympian. So it is a period of, say, 10 years, 15 years is what we need to spend time and effort. Still, so many of them are putting in effort. Everyone doesn't get into Olympics. So what happens? So still, you are mentally strong. You have built the confidence. You have, you know, learned how to fail and also face the situation. Right. So that is a positive attitude we are talking about in today's young generation.
And then, as you say, not everyone can become an Olympian, but everyone who has trained has developed that resilience, developed that strength, discipline involved. That's applicable in other areas of their life. And of course, there's going to be disappointment to work through. But it sounds like you're building well-rounded people as well as those that will hopefully get on the podium.
Definitely, definitely. That is our goal. As many possible, we are, you know, putting in our effort to get the right talent and give them the right inputs and the environment and, you know, holistic approach, which will bring out the maximum talent of every person or every child.
Well, honestly, thank you, Vishy, for not only bringing Sajan over to the UAE and giving us someone to cheer for come Tokyo, but for this attitude. I think it's really wonderful and hopefully very useful to parents who are listening today who've got kids who want to go for gold as well. For anyone who wants to find out more about your swimming academy, what's the best way of getting in touch?
They can contact me or reach out on our Facebook, AnsaDXB, equanationsportsacademy.com. They will be able to get all our information. Follow us on Instagram, AnsaDXB, hashtag AnsaDXB.
Well, so I know you're going to be
here to help them. Yes.
I know you're going to be screaming your head off come race day, but please keep us posted on everything and we'll be shouting along as well.
Definitely, definitely. Pleasure.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer, live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5. Don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. It helps other people find us, boost us in the ratings, and you'll get it direct to your phone.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.